think it's the emotion of multitude, or the it's virtual yeah. music from the 50s on. We were being subjected to fucking compression. Your technical talk is changing the sound, and you know Mozart can't make it like that with his orchestra. So you moved
yes,
into.
He can. Yes,
what?
He can. He can because the averse of compression is phase shifting, and when
no, it's not phase shifting, but okay.
No, it's phasing the different sounds. For example, when the first symphony was played through whomever was through a full house with full people in it would sound differently than an empty house with no people.
Yeah, that's not compression.
No, it's not. I'm talking
that's
about
acoustic.
Phase. But when you compress, you will change the phase.
Not necessarily, because I
but
use a lot
you
of
have
compressors
that
simultaneously
technology.
With the original signal, and the phases are very close.
Yeah,
that's not
when
a
you have
it's
electric
a change of
technology,
amplitude, not phase.
Dave, when you have all that technology you have in your studios and start 56, 70s, you're altering the fucking hearing process, you know? And
yes.
And it's virtual. Call that virtual music. It's
yeah,
not.
Yeah.
It's not organic analog. A fucking guy on a fiddle. It's hugely distorted and fused and perfected. So we've
yeah.
been in phases of virtuality, and so it doesn't matter what. Doesn't matter what a kid hears today. You can put the worst shit on, from our perspective, and the kid is at 9 years old. He's in love with a little girl in grade four, or he likes her, and the music comes on, and it's all virtualized and altered, and you know, MK altered. He is hooked. He's gone. He's been programmed, imprinted. He's gonna like that, right?
You can't. Yes, we're that's sort of the one of the principles we've been saying. Yes.
Yeah,
like,
and
Bob, just like you, Bob, being interjected with Spinning His Wake at, what, 9 years old?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's, I'm like Spinning His Wake at everybody.
Well, about,
sorry, that's what I fucking grew up with.
Bob, earlier we were also talking about the 72 and the music dying in 72. And remember, people start going insular as everything becomes fragmented and broken down, and also more refined, we break down all the fragments and ins and out of it, just like we try and break down DNA and the body and all these little components. So
yeah, the technology gets better. It gets better in 72, but the chemical body community is gone. You know,
see, that's right. Now it all becomes deconstructed and fragmented. Exactly.
Right. So that, in other words,
you guys come in on Tuesday and you come in on Friday, and we'll do blow the rest of the
yeah.
time.
Hey, Dave, that's where the multiple body dynamic starts to apply. That's what he fucking. We made a discovery. The music died because the technical body started to be isolated from the chemical body, and people
yeah.
were enjoying the virtual reality of music in the 70s, the young kids, but they had no community. The fucking
yes,
mauling and suburbanization, they did not have the context of the Bronx R&B singers. They didn't have that
yes,
anymore.
Yes, no, remember, you still get the
and they couldn't be political. They knew they'd be shot, so politics died.
Yes, but you know, that's right. Well, and also people needed an antidote to the nasty news. But also, don't forget too that oh god, the OJs and so many of those bands, they still had the residue of like the happy
yeah.
65
yeah.
and the collective, the love train, and still let's
the chemical body.
Progress.
They still
yeah,
had hints of the chemical
expressive
body,
expressive positivity kind of thing. Still,
yeah,
like, brightness,
you're missing
hope
one
for
point.
Humanity. What's that?
And I should bring this up. You're missing one point. My birthday was October 1st, 1956, and the first day that I was going to be drafted to Vietnam was the second day that it was annulled. So I was thinking about, you know, do I want to go to Vietnam? It's like I'm just getting out of high school, and I'm the first date of the draft. So I got to go down to my post office, and then the next day, the war is over.
Ooh.
Within 48 hours.
So what happened? So what's your point? What happened?
Well, that was part of the music structure for me.
Right.
That there are some of us who were at that beginning of going to Vietnam that were drafted, and my birthday was the first to be drafted, and the next day it was done.
So you were happy that day, right?
Naturally.
Right,
well,
so you're
yeah,
saying the music you heard in your happiness imprinted you.
Well, that goes back to the Babysitters when I was 7 and I listened to Wipeout. That was
right.
the beginning of my drumming. That drumming
right.
solo from Wipeout structured me as my for my drumming.
Right, but what's your point about the annulment? Relate that to music.
I'm just saying that there's a lot more going on than what they he needs to add more content and more color because what the
Yeah, that's where the music
about.
Music is an environment, said McLuhan. That's the beginning. Then it becomes multi-bodied. And Mozart's only playing for a chemical body and maybe a little bit of astral body thrown in there, but he's not he's pre-virtual.
The day the music died was part of the Vietnam War ending, too.
Yes. Yeah, and the Kent State, the murder
right.
of the students.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That's right.
And then there's the black of probably Jackson fucking prison riot, and the blacks at Attica happens in 71. So there was these archetypal program meme destroyers that wrecked the sociality of the chemical body, its last gasp in the 60s. So they called, Lester Bangs called the 70s the bland 70s, the bland-out, not freak-out, bland-out, because the virtual reality of technology was taking over and there was no ground for the chemical body community anymore.
Right, Hoffman wrote Steal This Book and...
Yeah. Well, no, that's 68. That's 68.
Yeah, that's just machine gun.
Yeah, Hendrix dies in 70. That's another thing. The music died. Hendrix dies. Joplin dies. They all die within a few months of each other. And then Jim Morrison dies in 71.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a repeat pattern of the late 50s.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. In other words, I bet you that song, The Day the Music Died, came out before Hendrix died. I think it comes out earlier.
No, it didn't. It came out in 72.
Not 70?
No.
No.
And you checked that, Dave.
I will right now. Hang on. Because I remember
well, the
it
was thing is, with Coltrane
yeah.
and Bud Powell, you know, you talk about people who didn't listen to music. I was into jazz because when I first heard jazz, my dad's console... I heard the drugs, I heard everything, and I was like, that's music to me. I just totally shut out all rock and roll. For 10 years, I thought it was all junk, because jazz was everything to me.
What year was that?
71.
What are the 10 years?
It was 1967.
67 to 77.
It's 1967 to 73. And then, I used to live in the band room, literally, and... there were some girls playing Beatles, and, you know, I thought, whatever. And now I appreciate that stuff and how cutting edge it was, but there was no rock and roll in my life. It was all...
because your sense of identity, you wanted to go with the sophisticatedness, or you wanted complexity
in
your mind.
No, it wasn't sophisticated. It was through the drugs. I could hear the heroin through Coltrane. I could hear the teeth being pulled out of Chet Baker. I could hear...
Right.
The pain of the people.
So jazz, you're talking
through.
About free jazz. That was your music for 10 years because you could hear the drug in it. The drug.
Well, my parents left, and I was kind of raising myself, and the music resonated to me. It
right.
spoke to me.
Right.
Rock and roll.
It's like a darkness.
Rock and roll needed a structure. Jazz did not need a structure.
Yeah.
It was the ghetto, it was everything, and I was white in the white neighborhood, but I could feel the sound.
That would be the mixture of satellite color TV and whatever computers. You were starting to go into what McCoon called the tactile mud, and Coltrane's music, you know, post-visual, you were experiencing the tactile mud, and drugs got you into the tactile mud.
I didn't do drugs, but I could hear it to them.
Yes. You would get the drug effect from the music.
Yes.
You required the tactile mud.
Yeah.
And then the mixture, then disco comes on late 70s, and the techno mixture is different. It's responding to cable TV or something, and you come out of the mud, and now you kind of got a virtual plasticity or... an individual takes over, you know, what's his name dances. It's back to a singular dance.
It goes back to your word, Bob. It goes back to your word. I never listen to lyrics. I just listen
right.
to the beat and the rhythm. But you provide the word to what I was missing in those early
right,
beats
right.
and lyrics. Like you're the beatnik. You're like the poet beatnik of the 60s.
Right. Yeah. And Dave's right, the thing fucking song came out in 72, which is not my memory.
71, actually, you're right. No, but it was 71. But the main point is it was responding to the whole, the Altamont.
Everybody
fact,
died.
Yeah, it went shitty again or whatever.
Yeah,
we are,
Morrison
what are
died
we?
In June 71. Do they get, so it is after, it's after Hendrix, and Joplin and Morrison. So that they actually
not to mention the Kennedys and Martin Luther King.
Right, but the day the music died, he was actually talking about after rock, all the big 60s guys died. That was
right.
a replay
but
of
his,
Buddy
Hidden
Holly.
Ground was is a re yeah, but the Hidden Ground is exactly that. It's a hologram of what is playing out within his situation that he's going
yes,
through this
Dave,
transition
that's
to
the answer
71
I was looking
period.
For. The hologram. It wasn't just those guys. It was a hologram. Yeah. That was the answer I was looking for. Thank you.
Yeah. And you know what the hologram is, Mark? That is the effect of the satellite computer and TV environment. You didn't have a little hologram made by the hologram, but the effect of that mixture made the word makes a hologram before the technical hologram showed up. Is that what you mean? That's what I mean, but is that what you mean?
No, that's what I want to hear.
What?
When I said hologram, I meant it almost like a metaphor so that the present that they were in, they thought they were looking at the past, but the past was actually just a hologram of the thing that they were going through, but they couldn't see it because it was happening right then. Exactly. Yeah. So with them, it would be the Buddy Holly and the thing where, like you said, you've got then, and he probably was aware of that and had the same emotion. Oh, again, another decade, and look at all the big bright lights go all out at once.
Yeah, the decade becomes a hologram. That's right. Yeah. The year is a hologram, then the decade, and that's what I meant by homeopathic. I invented this thing that it's diluted, like homeopathy, all through the 70s and 80s and 90s, and it gets tinier and tinier. And like Madonna is an interesting thing. I cannot enjoy her music other than that one dance dressed me up in 1985.
You like
the
that,
rest
like
of it's fucking ridiculous. But you know, I think Eliza, she sends me a Madonna song. She grew up with that. That's fucking her heavy imprint. That's like Mozart, God music to her.
Yeah,
you know. But it's responding to a hologram.
Body? Let's hear you. What? Let's hear you do an a cappella version of "Dress You Up."
Okay. Well, can I have it on in the background?
If you wish.
Dress me. I don't even know the lyrics, so.
You got style. That's what all the.
Dress you up. Yeah, I'm walking down the stairwell. I get the video in my mind.
Sheets and luxury so fine.
Oh, I can't
all
sing.
All sheets are custom made in.
Yeah, I can dance to that. You got the rhythm. You got it. You're fucking good. You're good, Dave. Dave to a camping trip because he can fucking sing.
Not really, but I can depict the song. I know the phrasing. Anyways, yeah, buddy, that is a good one.
Whatever.
Yeah. I remember I played it here. I played it. That was my first at Beverly Tavern in November 85, and I put that on. I just seen it. Which is interesting. Hey, I'm responding to teenage imprint stuff. I still had the ability to respond to an imprint.
Oh.
Of what other generations liked.
Bob, I hate to see you get jaded.
Good taste. I can almost hear the thousands of years later the music that's good, right? Even though
I think it's amazing. Well, Bob, if you're 92 and you're
maybe
not jaded,
it sounds
that's
like
impressive.
Hello?
Oh, Bob, I think we all got lost in the line because I've been trying to respond to you and you haven't heard. I'm not sure if we're still
here.
What? I hear someone else here. Who's here?
Yeah, it's me. It's Mark. You know, I'm still here. I don't know. It's not like
Bobby got lost. You notice he wasn't like he was talking and he wasn't hearing what we were
Bob's
saying.
Yeah, Bob's knocked off. Bob got knocked off. He'll check in back in a minute.
Okay.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know if I was muted or not. It's Allison. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Allison.
Hey, he should be. I'll be quiet when Bob gets back on. I was just going to say my son is here. He's also a musician. He's visiting for the week and. He was listening. He's like, I want to know when they're going to talk about Joy Division.
Oh, well, I don't know a hell of a lot about Joy Division, but if he can come on if you want to, if he's in the house now or whatever, feel like coming on.
Yeah, explain to me. I saw them. They were popular, and I go, who the hell is these people? You know,
Joy Division?
You know,
no, they were very big. Yeah, well, they have the big song that everyone knows, Love Will Tear Us Apart. Do you know that song? Love Will Tear Us Apart. Again, it's really.
I just wanted to hear his interpretation of why he likes it. What the music means to him.
He's here, and I'll let him. We also, by the way, we went to see Nine Inch Nails on Friday night.
Yeah, I've heard that's a good tour. This one. Did you like it?
It was
Resnick.
It was epic. It really was. I mean, we've seen him a couple times together, actually, and this was by far my favorite. So,
well, you're a good mom, aren't you? I nominate you as Mom of the Year if you're going to do Resnick with your son.
Well, you'll love this. That's the one I went to Burning Man with this year. This is the same son. We're actually an old music family. He was raised on, you know, the Grateful Dead and Neil Young and all that stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
So I guess, and then he ends up a musician.
Bob, stuff of Bob's crap.
Anyway, what did you want to talk about, Joy Division? Here.
I was just going to say, hi, everybody. I was just going to say, when you were talking about Jim Morrison and everybody dying and Janis Joplin and the whole 27 Club.
Right. And then to start the next decade with him dying, which is kind of neat. Yeah, that's right. Eh? So he's like dies in 80 or 81. And who else famous died about then that was sudden? Did T-Rex not die around then?
He might have, yeah. But Ian was 23, which kind of was interesting to me because that kind of knocked the 27 number off a little bit. I don't know.
But also remember what I thought was neat too is, well, not neat, but when he died, he put on The Idiot, which was a semi-recent album at the time. Iggy Pop was sort of first solo album without the Stooges. And that he had that album, he put on that album, and then I guess hung himself, I believe it was. And
who, Dave? Who?
Ian Curtis, the singer for Joy Division. So when they came in and found his body, yeah, that song was like, this record was just chung, chung, chung.
Was he 27?
23. But,
well, but, who was 27 and 81 that you were saying was the 27 Club?
No, we're not saying that it has to be a precise age of 27 in that sense. It's not like the 27 Club, but the whole demarcation of someone dying. Now, in the case of him, what I would say is what would he represent from the past? And in a lot of ways, he represented kind of moving forward and trying to get a slightly new form of music, no?
Are you post-punk?
Yes, well put, exactly. Well put, yeah, post-punk.
So he was reaching past it.
A little more, the drums had more of a disco thing, because it was ultimately became New Order later, so they were predisposed to making steady-sounding dance music.
I never knew the Joy Division. I even thought it was a girls' band or something. I used to mix up.
You know what it's named after, obviously. The Joy Division was in the concentration camps.
Right.
Jewish prisoners, they would use them for pleasure.
Right. Yep. But was there a girls' band called the Joy Division?
No.
No, okay.
I thought yesterday.
It would have been a nice name for a girls' band. Like, Connie could have had a band called the Joy Division.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
No suicide
yesterday.
That
thing.
Are you thinking of the Joy Formidable?
Maybe that's it.
What is it?
No, it's Joy Division. I saw three girls.
No, no, what did the other guy just say?
That's Jesse, my son. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Jesse. What did Jesse say?
I was wondering if you were maybe thinking of the Joy Formidable. That might be a girl band. I'm not certain.
The Joy Formidable.
Looking it up right now.
Right. Anyways, Joy Division, Dave. For years, I thought it was a girl band or something, and only about 2 years ago, I looked it up, and there was this guy, and then he was an archetype in a certain phase in the 80-81 period.
Right.
And I never knew their music.
Big influence. I know the bands that I worked with moving into. See, the English stuff was huge influence, and also in the later 80s, well, more like the early 90s, there was music that was known categorically as shoegazer music. My Bloody Valentine was like the sort of most well known.
Yes, we played that.
It was a lot of really brilliant stuff, and there were a lot of other cool bands in that era too that were doing similar neat stuff like that. So that was a really cool period of music. It's also very influential, and I found pattern was there's a lot of kids, you know, my age and a little younger-ish kind of, you know, maybe like 10 years younger even, and they were really, in the late 90s, their whole thing was that shoegaze was fucking about the best thing that had happened, even cooler than grunge, and that Joy Division and the Velvet Underground and Sonic Youth were like, you know, just doesn't get any cooler or cooler.
Yeah.
Basically, I noticed that pattern a lot. So Joy Division was always considered a highly respected and seminal and a band that was kind of doing their own thing. So that's, I'd say, the cachet that they have. But let's just take a little excerpt. Bob, do you know this song by them? It's a beautiful song. This one? Check it out. I'm just holding the phone to the speaker.
Yeah.
Lovely, yeah. Eh? What a great package. That's, nice beat, great bass line, beautiful
style. That's when they added strings to Fats Domino. This is strings added to punk.
Not just strings, but disco music. And remember, Sucks was very powerful sentiment in
like
rock.
Zappa, as a young teenager, he hated when they added strings to the R&B black guys that he was into, and he wasn't into Elvis because that was too white. But when they added strings, it was disgusting. But here you got that stringer and disco added to punk. That's post-punk.
Yeah, when the strings came in the 70s, which punk supposedly reviled in some ways. So yeah,
right.
Re-embracement.
See, so you get the punk, you get people liking the punk, the raw punk, and then eventually they're going to get bored, and then they'll respond to the bright sounds of strings.
Of course.
Yeah, it goes back and forth.
Yeah, and simultaneously now at this point, because it's so, you know what I mean, so much, so refined at this point. But
well, what's amazing is the young people make lumpy gravy kinds of music now. They put in sound clips and voice and fragments and noise and then neat music. They do the collage that Zappa pioneered.
You know, I'll tell you an interesting anecdote from Barry Gordy.
No, do you agree with that? They do the, you know, over the last five, 10 years.
Music's too diverse to know, because, you know what I mean? Like, one set of kids will do one kind of thing, and there's so much damn music out there that are covering so many possible permutations.
Too much
there
damn
one that you could lock into and see that one.
We're too fucking rich.
Yeah, that's all true. No, it does. This abundance of art is making people almost like, what the hell are
we doing? They're depressing people because their chemical body are yearning for community, and they can't get any because it's too much wealth.
They're just swamped with a hologram of it.
Yeah, the holograms. Yeah, the holopathic injections.
Yeah. But I wanted to say Barry Gordy, you know, he's got a wonderful biography that he wrote called To Be Loved, and it's got a lot of neat stuff in it. And one of the things he says is he had this hit with Marvin Gaye in about 62, and it was we did it really raw, you know, we didn't really pay a lot of attention to the recording. And it went to like number, you know, like 8 or something. It was really doing well in the charts, so we thought, fuck that, let's do a proper version. We got money, so they hired strings and all that stuff. And he goes, it went to about like number 27, and then...
Right.
Because no one dug it, because he did, and all this.
He actually hit the nerve of the desire for raw.
Exactly.
In other words, the palate is there. The levels of, it's like Gurdjieff's decibels of the octet, and all they're there, and it's a figure ground, and the mix makes raw happen for 6 months. And then it switched to sweet strings or disco. You know, it's a modulation, and Joyce tried to write that in a book, tried to write those ratios changing. It's not a melody anymore. It's mood mud.
Mm-hmm.
Tommy Garrett and the 50 Guitars.
Beg your pardon?
Well, Tommy Garrett and the 50 Guitars, the Wrecking Crew, but better yet is Stax. There's a new book out on the Stax recording studio. And
is that the Memphis Gang?
Memphis. Yes, Butler, Memphis John, and Booker T. And
the
discovery of Otis Redding. And the Otis Redding story is phenomenal. I heard it on the radio 3 days ago, and I never knew.
You never knew what?
How diligent the janitor was that he could sing. And the last audition of him, when they were auditioning people in the Stax, STAX, they go, oh, well, we got this guy that's been bugging us. He's got to come up, and we'll allow him to sing. And it was Otis Redding.
Wow.
The number one seller for Stax was Otis Redding.
And, right, for about a year or two, right? Try a little tenderness and whatever the other one, on the dock of the bay.
Yeah, well, he died. And that
67, right.
Posthumous. He died before that song came out.
That's right. Now, that's a tragedy. It would have been interesting if he fucking stayed alive. What would happen? He probably would have OD'd by 75, like Marvin Gaye or something, but it would have been interesting what he would have done.
He would have gone,
Marvin Gaye would have started doing
recording disco records, and then people would have got bored of him because he was old. That's what happened to most people from that.
Wait, Otis Redding. You're saying Otis Redding would have gone disco?
If Otis Redding had lived, he would have probably gone like Smokey Robinson, started recording more disco-flavored records and doing blow.
Right.
Yeah, probably.
Because it's an environment. They're all singing, and they're good singers, but the digital reality is wrecking their sense of their chemical body identity, and they got to tune into the speed of the TV reality, and they all go drug. Drugs are the only way you can survive.
Yeah, well,
I don't want to say
you think that's the only way.
Exactly. Well put, yes.
Yeah, and so the hype speed up of life, it's really interesting. All that beautiful music that I love fucking ruined people because it was a soundtrack for people getting more and more discarnate, more speeded up, and losing touch with their chemical body and going virtual, and then they prefer to keep up with the virtual, so they're taking coke while we're on the way to the studio.
It was incessant. It was part of the water. It was horrible.
Yes.
I mean,
the water,
it was horrible.
It was post-human, which is exactly what McLuhan was saying. By the late 50s, it's post-human. And nobody even could. They got to read Philip K. Dick 30 years later, a guy that starts to intuit it. But McLuhan was way ahead, maybe even Burroughs. They were way ahead of everybody on that point.
Yeah, Philip K., Dick. Oh, my God. That's a whole story in itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
did you know him?
I never met Dick. I didn't read his stuff. I didn't really know about him. And he was a closet. You couldn't meet him. He was a fucking recluse. And the guy, the PR man for Dick was Robert Anton Wilson. And so he shows up, and, you know, I played it last night, my encounter with Wilson. Did you hear, Dave? It's funny. I'm yelling at him, I saw you at the Toronto Memorial Library in 1985. I'm citing, you know, the library that you know so well, right? At Bloor and Young. Where are you, Dave?
Yeah, there you are. I'm here.
That's where I first met. I went there, and some local, dead old hippie liked Robert Anton Wilson because they were still trying to live in the Tim Leary world, and Wilson was the connection to that. And they brought him to the library, and only like 50 people were there. And I attacked fucking Wilson because he was, I don't know, whatever the reason, because I thought I was right and he was wrong, and I hardly knew much about him. But I didn't like his audience. That's what it was. These were the CKLN audience around Brad Pitt or whatever. Really? Was that his name, Brad Pitt?
No.
He had the famous name?
I know who you mean. No, it wasn't. That wasn't his last name.
But you know Brad. Remember
I know. Program director for a few months.
For 5 minutes. But he was too lazy. He was an old hippie, and he'd play the late 60s music Saturday night like a Grateful Dead guys. And those kind of sleazy, out of date by 1985, they were lost, right? And they might have been in the 30s. They liked Robert Anton Wilson. So
gotcha.
I went there. I used to say, I never read Margaret Atwood's book, I just study your audience. So I used to do that in Barnes & Noble. Go and look at the audience, judge the audience, then react accordingly. I would condemn an author for his lousy audience. Because people did give off decadal smells. You know what I mean? Decadal smells.
Bob, always thinking, what a bore, you're not on the cutting edge, you're just clearly with the pinks.
I always had, you don't even know fucking Zappa, you're not listening to Bongo Furry, you're not processing, you're not living in the present.
Yeah.
You don't have to like Zappa, but you must process, Frank. You must imbibe him.
is Jesse still on the line?
Jesse?
Yeah.
Jesse?
Yeah,
are you here?
Hold on.
Hey, Dave, you'd like this.
Yeah.
You know, I used to talk to Jim Patterson at CKLM, and he's a, you know, many generations younger, but I'd talk to him, interact with him. In I met him in 1985. Like 20 years later, in 2005, he writes me an email and says, "You're right, Zappa is great." 20 fucking years later, he heard Make a Jazz Noise Here.
Yeah.
So it's always a running joke that he was 20 years behind me, and he was a DJ and I wasn't, but he had not processed Zappa. And then decades later, he got it. And then he went over to Morocco with his wife, girlfriend, whatever they are, longtime partner, and they're out there with a fisherman in Algeria, way nowhere land, and this guy there, local guy, and they get talking about music, and Jim says, "Who's your favorite guitarist?" And the guy says, "Frank Zappa." That floored Jim. I mean, he basically couldn't believe that I was right out there, that I had the right guy. Jim,
yeah.
Jim couldn't hear it.
Yeah, Jim Patterson.
Yeah, he was impressed. He's romanticizing the third world out there in Morocco.
Yeah.
And he's out there, and they've got the most virtual guy is their favorite guitarist.
Yeah.
Zappa was the most virtual.
Bob Formation.
Yeah. Are you understanding this, Jesse and Allison and Jim McDonough? He fucking came in, talked, and then he just faded out. It's irresponsible. Why? Stay with it. You know, you're not going to be heard for 10 minutes, but you wait it out, you get to be heard again. What?
Could you get a word in edgewise?
Who couldn't?
Anybody.
Well, speak now.
Okay, speak now. What do you want to say?
I have nothing to say at this time.
His mother's complaining for his deadhead kid.
No, Bob. Conk him out.
He can't get it away. That's beautiful. I can't get it. My kid cannot get a word in edgewise. Okay, well, give him an opening. Sorry, Mom, I don't have anything to say.
Jesse,
Bob, ask Jesse a question.
Jesse, who's your favorite drummer?
I'm a big Jane's Addiction fan. They're my favorite of all time. So Stephen Perkins is pretty amazing to me, but I'd probably have to go.
You're talking too fast. I'm not hearing anything. What did he say, Dave?
He said Jane's Addiction, Stephen Perkins.
Right.
And he'd also have to.
I would say Stephen Morris from Joy Division 2 is a very amazing, underrated drummer.
Well, what about the Zappa drummers, Jesse? Terry Bozzio and those guys, do you know them?
So I know Zappa a little bit, not a ton. So, you know, I can't.
What'd you say?
I said they're gods. He doesn't know the God aspect yet.
No. What does Jesse say? Does he know Terry Bozzio and those guys?
I don't.
Oh, okay, so you missed the Zappa. Like, Dave, Terry Bozzio is considered a god now, right? With his big drum.
He is a god. Give up on him, Bob. Let him explore it. Jesus.
Oh, we got Mark here. He'll support me. So you agree that Zappa's drummers are great.
Well, Terry Bozzio's a god. I mean, Bob, lay off.
He's ascended.
I want to hear the disciples. You know, I don't want to. I know who God is. He doesn't know who God is.
Jesse, yeah, so what do you want? What do you want? You want? Is he a disciple? Jesse's a disciple? Is that what you're saying?
No, his drummers are disciples. I want to hear the drummers that he likes.
Right, so we just heard them.
Totally.
Did he repeat them?
Sure.
Joy Division. No, Jane's Addiction. Somebody else, Steve Morris or something.
Oh, Steve Morris? Oh, you got to be kidding me, dude.
Do it again, Jesse. Do your fucking list again.
Steve Perkins, Steve Morris, of course, our great Steve Moon, John Bonham.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else?
How about Bill Bruford?
I was a dead kid, so I, you know, Mickey Hart's pretty up there for me.
Yep.
Let's see.
Hey, you know who John Bonham was influenced by? That was like the drum god?
Ringo Starr?
No.
Oh, no.
Who?
Clyde Stubblefield, the drummer in James Brown's band.
Oh, yeah. God, I didn't know his name.
He would just play James Brown records and just like stay steady with them. And he really brought that to the Zep.
Did you guys see the movie Muscle Shoals?
Yeah, what about Muscle Shoals? The muscles that wasn't that they did also. Didn't the Atlanta guys go down to Muscle Shoals too? And wasn't Respect recorded with that same crew with Steve? I think it was because Steve Cropper was also in her tour.
Yeah, right. Who said Muscle Shoals? That Madeline?
No, yeah, that's
Allison. When is Muscle Shoals? I remember the name, but I don't.
65, 68. It's really his heyday, I guess.
Yeah,
is that Soul? No, Memphis is Soul. No, where's Aretha Franklin?
That was recorded at Muscle Shoals, I'm pretty sure, in Alabama. It's in Alabama.
Soul. Yeah.
That's Motown.
And that's weird, because you know what's in the middle part of the hole? That was where, you know, in the Torba document, it comes up a lot, that place is a lot
right.
of the privatized and military activity was going on there, too.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Here's something, and this is, I don't know if this is the best, because this isn't the one, but here's something, here's a treat for Jesse. I'm going to have to bring the speaker to the phone to the speaker again, so just hang in there. Check it out. It's going to come at you real soon. But this isn't probably his best groove, but this guy is unbelievable. Maybe you know him. Hang on, he's coming at you. Here we go.
It's time to take you on a journey of some 16th notes. And we're going to have a little fun with this, because this one has the tendency to have a certain kind of flavor of easiness. And it goes something like this. I want to, you know what to do.
There's a better one. This is one where he's playing with the band. It's better when he's alone and he talks. He goes, okay, and now when I did this, and then when I was playing the hi-hat, I accidentally left out this note. And I'm like, whoa! But you can see he's good. He sounds a bit like Bonham, too. He plays in, like, Steely Dan on Barry White. I mean, he's a highly sampled drummer.
You're referencing Stubble White, and Stubble White's talking there?
Yeah, he's not so much on this one. He has another video where it's like a music lesson. He's, like, describing and how he discovered some of his little beats. A lot of them were mistakes. He goes, I accidentally left out a note one time, like, holy macaroni! And then he's like, or I accidentally opened the hi-hat on this one beat one time, like, whoa! And the way he describes it, he's so charismatic. And when he plays, you know, he's just got such a pocket and such a feel that it just, you immediately want to start dancing. I mean, he's just, what's this one? Bernard Purdy, he's called Bernard Purdy, Funky Donkey. You know what he has on his drum set? He's on this Steely Dan, he has a sign, he has on this one tom, it says, you done some, I don't know exactly, but something like it said, you done gone do it. And then on the other tom, the sign said, you hired the best hit-making drummer in the business. He's a really fun guy. Let's see if, hang on, let me see this one. Here he comes again. Oh, no, hang on, what's this one? Oh, this is one of his solo, oh, he has a solo album. Where's the beats? Hang on.
That's what I call
it. Oh, it's got music. Now, I want him just talking. Hang on, what about this? Let me just look. Sorry while we're doing it. Jesse, just say some other shit, or Bob, say some other stuff. I'm just going to see if I can find Broom Birdie.
That's what I call.
Mark wants to say something.
Okay.
That's what I call counting while you walk. What you just first heard was a strut walk.
Yeah.
The Purdy Shuffle. Okay, he's going to explain this Purdy Shuffle. This is what he felt was his fresh feel that he felt was very unique to him. I believe this is the one. He's going to explain the Purdy Shuffle. This is the one. He's fucking funny. Here.
Now.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Now that we've got the 12-4 and the 12-8, I'm going to explain to you. Remember that word. Call. Not explain, but I'm going to explain to you what the Purdy Shuffle is all about. Going to surprise you. It's quarters. It's eight. It's 16. It's dotted. About half time, and you can also add to that a whole note. And I'm going to explain to you by playing it all.
Nothing. He has other ones with cooler beats, but he's fantastic.
Well, when was that? How is he dead?
That's about 70 or something. No, he's probably still alive. He's old, but
right.
He would have probably played well into the 80s and 90s in L.A. on sessions because, you know, he had already played on so many smash records.
Hey, Dave, here's some esoterica. So there's this guy, Ray, who is an R&B fanatic, and I met him in New York, and in 2004, we went down to Hard Rock Cafe, and Ray knew James Brown. So everything was sold out. But we managed. He had no money, but I had some money. But we found a guy who sold the tickets. So we go up to the lineup, and as we arrive at the entrance, up comes Johnny. Can't remember his name right now. He's the guy who ran the record store in the 50s in Harlem, and he's the one who discovered James Brown.
Mm.
So Ray knows him. So we walk in. This is an example of Bob's serendipity. We walk in with this guy, and because he's an eminence grease, everybody knows him, or enough people know him, he just walks. It's all jammed. You can't get into the room. He just starts walking forward. He's 80 years old or something, and the C parts. So Ray and I walk in behind him. Ray knows him, but I don't know. And we go right up to the front and stand there, and then James Brown comes out, and he acknowledges Johnny, whatever his name is, Bobby Richardson, I guess it was Bobby something, and then, of course, he acknowledges Bobby, so we have got the top guy, because Bobby made James Brown famous, 50 years before. So then, after the concert, Bobby walks me and Ray in, and we get to meet James Brown. And we showed up at the last minute, and we got in when Bobby walked by, and he doesn't pay, and Ray and I walked in behind him. Now, how's that? Pretty
cool.
Good.
So what happened when you met James Brown?
He asked me, I use my old line, he asked
me... You asked him, hey, Bob, before you tell us, you asked him, so do you know my chart?
No, he says...
What chart, man? I don't use a chart.
Now, you know what he does? He looks at me and says, you're fucking good, look at this, he goes, you're a good dancer. Which I am.
What, before you even danced this, when you...
I didn't do nothing. He looked at me, I was introduced, and he goes, you're a good dancer. And I said, and he says, what, are you a musician? I said, yeah. He says, what instrument do you play? I said, I play the radio. He cracked up. I was the hippest thing in his life that night.
I bet. Because, Bob, that's pure Bob. That's a great
answer.
It's
pure Bob. I played the environment.
And you say it with such, no shame.
Yeah.
Maybe
I didn't know.
And no attachment either.
That's right. I didn't know he was going to ask me, but I was ready. So he asked me, he says, you're a good dancer. Are you a musician? Yes. What instrument do you play? The radio. And he falls over laughing his head off. He'd never heard that before.
Fucking funny. I don't think anyone said it since, buddy.
That's right. Yeah. I'm going to sell that one. If I catch anybody doing that to some musician, you fucking owe me a couple bucks.
You're going to hound them on chat forums or something.
Yeah. You use my line.
What?
Uh-oh, there's the echo. Uh-oh.
Check. Oh,
somebody was talking. Was it Allison? Someone came in and responded.
Yeah, is it better?
You know what would be funny?
Yeah, we responded. I just said maybe your doppelganger was dancing. He'd seen you dancing before.
Good
Your
point.
Other you.
He might have watched me bouncing. We were right underneath him on the stage, so he could have seen me bouncing. You're right. He could have been referring to watching my body rhythm as he was playing.
Right. Did you like the show?
What?
Hey, Dave?
Good show?
Mark.
Hey, Dave?
Yeah, it was good.
Mark.
What's that? Who said it? Allison?
I said, hey, Dave. I was just going to ask. Jesse just mentioned Pete Beck. I should let Jesse talk to you about it. He had dialed up a song called Elevator Music. And it had the same intro as what you just played.
Oh yeah, which one?
Really cool.
Which stuff that I played? Which one? Which song?
Hold on.
Butterfield or whatever his name, Butterwhite.
It's the intro.
Bernard Purdy.
Yeah,
Butterfield. Yeah. What is it? Clyde Butterfield?
Shuttlefield.
Okay. No, Bernard Purdy we're talking about. I mentioned Clyde Stubblefield. That's James Brown's drummer, but Bernard Purdy was the guy
narrating
as he was drumming.
Yeah.
Who plays on Steely Dan. I think he plays on Stevie Wonder. On a shitload of 70s records. But Allison, what were you saying again? Let's get that sorted out.
Jesse, so who was it who did the intro that went, 1, 2, you know what to do?
That was him, yeah. So that's what they... Oh, so who uses... Beck uses that on his answering machine. No, he called...
The first track on...
Elevator.
Elevator Music. It's, when you played that, I was going, oh, I've heard this before, and where was
right.
it?
Right. Uh-huh. That's where it's from, yeah. That's neat.
There's a little bit of it on there, which is too funny. Obviously, he's paying homage, hopefully.
We can play it. We have it dialed up.
Sure, go ahead.
Did that come through?
Not yet.
Pretty faint.
Yeah, we kind of can't do it loud enough then.
You can't bring the phone closer to the speaker of that, eh?
For some reason, the mic on this phone and the speaker on this computer aren't interacting very well. So.
Dave, you're sitting in your state-of-the-art studio, right?
No. I don't have a phone or anything like that in my studio, so I'm in the other building.
Oh, with your computer. Oh, okay.
I have a computer in here to run on the internet. I don't have internet either in the studio.
Right,
there's
right.
no phone line.
One more question about Beck, because Jesse was... I didn't know this. Did you know he released his last album? It was just sheet music?
Just what? Sheet music. That was the only form you could get it in. No MP3s, no no ditch, no download. Just sheet music.
Is that right?
Piano. How'd that go? Sold more copies than they did records.
People loved it, actually.
Sold 170 copies of that. You know, there are 120 of the record.
We're talking Beck. We're talking Beck.
I know, yes.
He's doing Prince. He's trying to be an individual like Prince in the 80s.
So did anyone buy it?
That's a good statement. Did you get that, Dave? Look,
he was trying to do a Prince in the 80s.
Prince was trying to become an artist, a unique individual, and he was doing all these media ecology things, and that's what Beck's doing. He's replaying Prince.
Yeah, it's like an after Prince.
Yeah. Yeah, an after image. Yeah. Bob releases a fucking confession. I went to Catholic Church and confessed. I released my confession. What's more primitive than sheet music? Whistling?
Good question. Just describing it orally or just singing
So that's what Bernard Purdy is doing. Purdy is just describing it orally.
Well, isn't that the retrieval with radio, wiping out the visual space environment?
Beethoven writing blind.
Yeah.
Beethoven writing blind.
Yeah, but he's all influenced by visual space prior to that. Of course, there's the rhythm and all the aspect of music, but he's got the legacy of visual space and then goes blind.
Yeah.
LaRouche said the first song that really combined rhythm, and he detested it as a result, and melody or whatever, was Bolero.
Right, that's right. He talks about that.
Yeah,
he makes He makes a big deal of Porgy and Bess too. He doesn't like that. That's phenomenal.
That's a drum beat. Bolero is a drum beat. It's the
beat.
And it's a building of tension and gradual building of emotion. So it's a very hypnotic thing. It's not. It's less intellectual. But I think it's a brilliant piece, and it's very intellectual sounding. The chords and movements are intense, and it's
that's why
way
Zappa
cooler than new stuff.
that Zappa would do Bolero in concert. He liked it. He used it. Yeah, he used to play Bolero. Do it.
Yeah.
I saw an amazing thing on Al Jazeera a few months ago. Great doc about this guy. He's from Lebanon that he made a lot of money. He's a businessman. He was originally from Afghanistan. So he thought, I'm going to go back and spend money and see if I can get other donors and people involved. And they got people even from Canada and Germany to ship, like, instruments and donate because the Taliban just devastated music. That was, like, decadent. So they just wreck the instruments and get rid of
the relics. There's a tactile culture wiping out acoustic space.
Yeah.
Or at least
but they loved music
analog.
Prior to that, and they had a huge legacy of
yeah, but they
music.
Had identity crisis from the tactile
right.
environment. It's like they're tactile. It's like liquor for Indians. They can't take it. You take a tactile Afghani society and lay tactile satellite environment, they go fucking nuts.
You can't see.
They lash out to rearview mirror and they kill acoustic space.
Especially when they're uneducated 18-year-old male morons.
Yeah, right, right. They lash out and kill acoustic space.
Just a little wrap on that story. It is basically, so the kids, of course, you could imagine they had like crap instruments, so finally they bring them in. So the kids had no prior training. It's amazing. Seriously, within, like, it became really fast. Some of the kids really had an aptitude for it and really were willing to also, like, and I think they even let them take the instruments home if their parents would allow them. They showed all these cultural bizarre nuances. It's quite amazing. And also, women are really segregated and they're bringing them into it. And can they play violins and still wear their shawls and not offend Allah and all these ridiculous things they have to deal with? but he sort of tried to navigate through all this stuff and get... And it's amazing. And then finally, they really started getting their shit together. It was like a mixture of they look like about kids from about maybe 9 to 16.
This is the Jack Black rock and roll school phenomenon.
Exactly. So they formed their little orchestra with about like 16 or 18 of them too. So it's pretty cool. And within about 2-3 months, man, they were like way better. Like they're like at about like kids in grade 11 or 12.
They were wrecking crew.
They were wrecking crew.
Standard.
It's true. And, yeah, that's meant their story. It just had so much oomph. But also, yeah. So they had like these like kind of UN-y people and kind of like the American ambassador and a few like kind of white collary guys, show distinguished sort of people who like theater and that show up to see how it all worked out and the money didn't get wasted. And they came and the kids did Bolero, and I was almost had tears coming because I watched it. It was also like a half hour documentary and you felt so sorry for these people and what they were going through, but the version was so intense that it just like it, and the people were clapping. It was like they were really touched by it too. It was so powerful. So
yeah,
in that way, it's like LaRouche had been there and he would have gone, what a terrible song.
Yeah. This is 425 megahertz. We got to go to
5.6.
This is fucking
bring
evil.
Back the Taliban.
Damn fucking evil. Yeah. Who is it? The swing girls. Those Japanese girls who do the jazz horns in that swing girl movie. That's pretty good. But you know what you have? You got these tactile Afghanis going acoustic visual, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century. And you've got Kanye West going tactile.
Yes.
With this ridiculous stuff he's putting out lately.
That's right. And that way, these kids were way more Western and literate because they were learning to read music and write it on a page. And, okay, you play this part, and we stop here, and then it continues
there.
See,
that's the thing. The American ambassador has to roam around the world to find pockets of American retrieval. He's in fucking Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Kanye West is fucking Kardashian and being tactile to the extreme with fucking ridiculous lyrics and grunts and spasms. And
what is Matt, how can you? That's an amazing picture you've painted. Is it also the decadence that takes place? Is this the whole innocence to the whole again?
Kanye West goes Taliban, and the Taliban go Western.
I don't see that pattern.
Well,
most kids that are in the orchestra aren't Taliban.
What are they? What are they?
They're just kids in Afghanistan, and now the government's saying,
Taliban.
No, you can go to school and learn music that's not illegal, and you won't get killed. Oh, okay, good.
Well,
how
did they pull that off? It was an isolated town where the Taliban didn't kill them or something?
I don't know if it was in the capital or what. It was in a slightly bigger town because in the whole thing, like, they're going through marketplaces, and there's, a fair amount of people doing shopping and stuff.
Hey, Dave, this is what's going on. Every culture under the tactile android meme, when the android meme wipes out humans, because it's just extending itself, then all the humans gather in their tribes, from big tribes to little tribes, and stand tall like Hillary yesterday, and they will not have it. It's nothing but pockets of tribal archetypes everywhere, all over the fucking planet. You know, and you got the American embassy, which is coming out of the 40s, and they go around looking for pockets of 40s music, bolero or something. You know what I mean? Everybody's propping up little mythic echoes of chemical body culture.
Yes. But it's so moving that makes you wish you were, like, involved in it. I saw they had another one in Al Jazeera, too, and I won't tell as long a story, but it was of an band in Africa, like, in the same thing, a really fucked country. And what's that one, oh, I think it's called O Fortuna, that they use a lot of movies. Oh, they roll, no. It's, like, a really intense, it's almost Wagnerian sounding. It's, like, fucking intense, you know. It's like Tchaikovsky on meth or something. It's crazy. But it's like, and they are playing it, and it was just the same thing. I was almost like tears to my eyes, because like, oh my god, like that's the essence of such powerful music, that you can play it to a virgin audience and they will be in awe.
Yeah.
And the players get struck in awe. And actually what Bill was saying,
what you gotta do, Dave, you gotta take away their cell phones, you gotta put them in an old fashioned music hall, and then the chemical body, then they respond to it.
Yes, and it becomes such an event and so meaningful, especially in Africa, because remember, that almost harkens back to Europe. Well, now they have, obviously, they have radios, they can retrieve music just like we can on the internet, but imagine back in Europe in, like, Beethoven's time, people would have, like, the sheet music for stuff, but they'd never know, is that how the feel is, or is that how you play it, or is that how that trill really sounds, or that kind of thing, or is that really the pocket or feel or temperament of the tune, and they would, the only time they'd ever get to know, if on the one rare time, once in their whole entire life, maybe Beethoven would actually make an appearance in Hamburg.
Yeah. And they'd find out
how it is supposed to sound like. For sure. And it's like, oh, that's what
it was very slow back then, Dave. Very slow. Slow
and
culture.
Yet the slowness creates an immense amount of involvement.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say it's more intense. Like Warhol said,
the one event is so magnified, and now we've got so many multitudes of events, and it just dims your response.
Yeah, and so you end up staring at your chip body. You know, you just keep looking at your thing and typing.
That's
your
the NUI paradox that eventually people will. I wonder what'll be the ascension from that.
Yeah, like Coker calls it boredom culture, but it's not a good enough term. You got to say which body is doing the boredom culture, because the chemical body is bored, but they're all fascinated with their chip body.
Yeah, so they're distracted. They're trying to meet the one need, but their chemical body's not being met, and they're also involved in this other distraction. So
it's
the chemical body's only. They can't focus totally just on the chemical body.
It's Wyndham Lewis, part communist, part fascist, you know, Marxist, my modern monarchism. And
how can you just play one card?
My chart, I'll explain my chart. That's this that's paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. That's the composite of the kid I see on the beach. They're going around the range of those experiences that they oscillate between. They got to do chemical body shit with their parents who took them to the beach. They got to do chip body stuff. They got to do whatever other astral body and mixture. The mixture of the bodies is represented chart by the psychological states.
Now when you say it is impressive. When you say the psychological states, can we what would
a paranoia? I'm just calling whatever paranoia. So then what it is really, though, it's the Android meme, and the content of the Android meme is machines, so it's not LaRouche and paranoia, it's radio and paranoia. It's TV and schizophrenia, computers and hysteria, and satellite and panic. That's the mixture.
Right. And right, because all of these mediums are still
That's the anthropomorphic. So you got radio retrieves paranoia in the Android meme, the whole radio sensibility, and then you lay a human form, LaRouche, on top of it. That's what Ian was saying to me, anthropomorphically, whatever the phrase was. He was referring to my chart, the overlay, not just the anthropomorphic quadrant. He actually was describing what is the purpose. Hey, it's actually, we got figured out. He goes, what, you got your anthropomorphic anti-crew. Nobody can connect with anybody because they got too many bodies to juggle. And he says, what is your purpose-driven reality? It is Ion. Ion is where all that fucking mishmash led to.
Hmm.
He defined himself in my terms. The purpose for the last 40 years was to evoke Ion.
And then where does it go from there?
We're right here today, having a good time.
Yeah, I don't know, Dave. You want experience tomorrow now?
Yeah, and not sleeping.